Have you always wanted tattoos?
Is that one of the five questions?
Oh, sure. Well, I'll count it.
Well, first, let me say welcome to Super Together. I'm James Cochran.
And I'm Ginger Rothis.
And we are kind of taking a detour from our more, I don't even want to say it's a detour from serious topics, but just a detour from our expertise.
Yeah, exactly.
And instead moving into a space where we can just have a more personable chat about some of our own stuff. So we each decided we're going to ask each other five questions. Ginger doesn't know the questions I'm going to ask her. I don't know the questions
know
she's going to ask me.
I'm going to ask you.
So that's where we are. And Ginger just asked me, have I always wanted to get a tattoo? So we're going to just pretend that that's the first question. I will say early on in my life, when I had maybe a more like fundamentalist view of Christian tradition or whatever, I was always sort of told like, oh yeah, you know, that would be like putting graffiti on the church because your body is God's temple or something like that.
Yeah.
Which was weird because the person who would say that to me was my stepdad, who also had a tattoo of a Doberman.
Did he regret it?
Maybe. I think it was more just like, you know, he didn't want, you know, the sort of do as I say, mm-hmm. not as I do kind of thing. And you know, from my mom, it was more of like the, you know, well, what's that going to look like when you're old,
right.
and your skin's all
skin
wrinkly
stretches,
or whatever.
Yes.
And, you know, I think when I got into maybe high school, there were some people, some like, young adult leaders in the youth group, you know, who were like volunteers, who had some really cool, like cross tattoos. Mm-hmm. This one guy had a cross tattoo, like across his whole back. And
wow.
I just remember thinking like, man, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So I'd always kind of envisioned that, had never really like, you know, put much thought into it. And then like my brother started getting a bunch of tattoos. My mm-hmm. mom started getting tattoos. And so I was just like, I mean, like, hey, if like all these
That's
people,
cool.
the boundaries kind of came off. Mm-hmm. And then, and then when I got my first ones about a year and a half ago, I got two tattoos in my wife's handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
One says for the girls, just as a reminder, for the girls in my sphere of influence, my two daughters and my wife,
mm-hmm.
You know, just to remember that that's why I do hard things. Mm-hmm. It's a signal of encouragement, but it's also sort of a broader, feminist reminder of, mm-hmm. That part of my work as a person of privilege being male, mm-hmm. Cis male, is to pay attention to how mm-hmm. the work that I do, the things that I say, the way that I interact with the world has to take responsibility for the girls. Because guys are doing fine.
Yeah.
You know, they've already gotten all that. And then my other one is, says Christ in you again, also my wife's handwriting, which is a nod to an incarnational worldview. Sort of my, theology, which is just based on, panentheism, not pantheism,
right.
but, panentheism, this idea that, God is beyond and above all things, but that God is also present in all things, living and not living, just all things that are created bear the image of God. So, you know, so the earth, nature, other humans of all stripes deserve my love, attention, and respect. So there are two just sort of reminders of how I want to walk through and live my life. And then, yeah, the other day I got a tattoo at Exile 2 in Westport from Bob Rodriguez. So shout out to Bob. They are in the midst of quarantine are taking it as seriously as any enterprise that I've walked inside of, with like temperature checks and hand sanitizer and masks and, limited foot traffic and closed doors and call aheads and all that kind of stuff, phone screens. So I got a forearm tattoo, which is a bunch of, flowers, sort of in a graphic style of Bob's. That's just really cool. And that's again a signal to an appreciation of creationism, sort of cycles of life and death, mm-hmm. flowers sort of being a symbol of emergent life and that kind of thing. So,
I love that.
So in answer to the very short question, have I always wanted a tattoo? Kinda, but also that desire. So now, like, I want to get tattoos all like head to toe tattoos. My wife is not a huge fan of my tattoos. Well, let me rephrase that. Like once they're on me, she
it's
loves
okay.
them because she loves me.
Right.
But,
right.
Yesterday it was Tuesday that I went and got the tattoo. And, as I was walking out the door, she's like, "No, you're sure. You're sure you want?" I was like, "Yeah, Lindsay, I'm pretty sure."
It's
like
Lindsay that's doubting.
Yeah, that's why I'm gonna put ink on my body forever.
I love it. So I thought that. So I've seen Christ in You for the Girls before, and I thought it was like a complete sentence. So I thought, live or recognize the Christ in you. Live as closely to Christ as you can for the women in your life. So that's pretty cool that to hear the meaning that you intended.
Yeah, no, they're two
different.
I mean, they're separate ideas. Obviously, I think that if you drill down far enough, like they mean ultimately the same thing.
Yes,
like, you know, how I move through the world, would want to be informed equally by both of those. And, living as though Christ in all things is also living as though, everything I do is for the girls because Christ is also in the girls.
Awesome.
And, so Ginger.
Yes, James.
What, how did you know you were in love with Rob?
Oh.
That's my first question for you.
Gosh. Okay. That's good.
And make sure to talk into the microphone.
Oh, I know. I start wandering around the room looking at all the people that aren't here. So, you know what comes to mind? Well, so we worked together, which is always an interesting start because we were friends and workplace, team members, really, at the beginning. And he's 6 years older than I was, so I was kind of the newbie young person, and he was 6 years my senior. So I respected him. I admired him. I liked the way he treated people. He was running a big consulting project that I was on, and I really just admired him, I think, at the start. But and then we grew as friends for months, and then finally started dating, which made work a whole lot more fun, and dating secretly, and like had this chemistry going on that we at our wedding, all of our coworkers came and said, "Oh gosh, we knew it all along. You weren't hiding anything from us." But it was kind of this fun thing of to think about going to work every day and seeing him. But I think one of the times I remember that I felt like he really got me and understood me was one of my first trips to visit him in Cincinnati, because we were living in two different cities. I lived in Kansas City. He was in Cincinnati, and we were working in a city in between. And I went to visit, and it was a holiday weekend, and it was the weekend that Princess Diana died.
Oh, wow.
And I can't remember now if that was a Memorial Day or Labor Day weekend, but I remember that Rob had gone out to get coffees in the morning, and he brought back this, like, a stack of newspapers. So this was before we had news on our phones.
Uh-huh.
And this was like 22, 23 years ago. And he said, "I'm so sorry. I think you're going to be really sad today."
Mm.
And then he handed me my coffee and the papers. But the way he said it was like, he gets me.
Mm.
Like, this man really understands that this is, I'm going to be sad. And we had never talked about Princess Diana. We had never, he just knew this was going to upset me. And I thought, okay, he really sees me, hears me, understands me in a way that just felt like, oh, he's like, he cares. And so that was probably one of the moments that I was really like, okay, I'm falling in love.
Oh,
I know.
No, that's, I love that, because I think that so often, you know, it would be easier for us to look at moments like we were on the beach and there were fireworks and everything was wonderful.
Right.
And I just looked into his eyes and, but instead it's like, no, like, he recognized, he was so deeply attuned to my experience that I felt seen. And that is, I think, what facilitates that deep connection.
Great
answer.
Yeah.
Okay, so your question number two.
Well, how did you know when Lindsay got you? Did you have a moment of feeling like she really understands me?
I don't know if Lindsay still understands me or understands me even now. You know, I think that Lindsay and I knew I was in love with Lindsay shortly after meeting her when we were sophomores in high school.
High school, okay.
And it was, for me, it was, this person is unique among the people that I have met in the way that she just opens her heart to others.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as a way of being, you know, like, she was so kind of beyond like the things that occupy most high schoolers that at the time I was like, whoa, I want like I saw in her who I wanted to be. Someone who like, who didn't care to be, you know, popular or, but wasn't like, you know, unpopular, you know, like because of that lack of interest in that pursuit, was just sort of able to live into that space. I thought it was cool that she didn't swear, because at the time I didn't swear, and that was like important to me for some reason. But again, there were all these signals to me. It's like, wow, this person is really different. And then, you know, through engaging with her, just like watching the way that she cared for and cared about people, was just really meaningful. One of my favorite, and I'm not sure precisely when this happened, and I think I was in love with her well before this. But she, we were driving along, and she, there was like a person in a car in another lane over who sneezed, and Lindsay said, "Bless you." Like when she observed that person sneeze, like this complete stranger who will never know, know that she was being blessed or whatever, but it mattered to Lindsay to offer that blessing. And I think that that signals to me like, you know, so for me, I don't know that I was drawn to Lindsay because I felt like she saw me as much as like she saw everybody. And she had such an expansiveness of heart, that I felt like I have to be as close to this person as I can be. And honestly, I think that that is one of the larger transformative experiences of my life, because I think it, I am, to whatever degree I am a kind, compassionate, caring, gracious person, 80% of that capacity is a direct result of Lindsay's influence. I believe that sincerely. I'm not saying I was like a bad person before, but I was much easier to be focused on myself and focused on my own needs and kind of where I am. But most of my growth has been as a result of Lindsay's influence. So
that's awesome.
yeah, we're getting mushier than we thought.
That's good.
So, my second question for you,
sure.
You have a daughter and a son.
Yes.
What is the difference between raising a boy and a girl?
Oh gosh, this could be a whole episode.
I think, and maybe this will, maybe we'll, for each of these, we'll follow up. We'll do a whole episode on tattoos, a whole episode on dating coworkers.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that'd be fun. It's amazing to see the hardwired gender differences, I think, I appreciate so much more. You know, I think back to that book in the 90s, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. And you know, there is some hard wiring that actually has helped me understand some of societal's behaviors, too. You know, because I think that there's conditioning that certainly happens in our society. But you just, we are made as different species. But I think that one of the things with having one of each, I think, has been good for Rob and I to both appreciate things about ourselves that we never had as like a mirror to you. And it's funny because my son is similar to Rob in demeanor and personality, and my daughter is more similar to me. And so we have these little in-house mirrors of, you know, the unhealed parts of ourselves and the good and the bad and the things that we criticize of ourselves. I really notice kind of we both see that in you know, in having a child of each gender. So, but yeah, I think that what it's helped me appreciate is how we are hardwired for behaviors, but we also can be taught a lot. And I think it's helped. I didn't, you know, I was an only child, so I didn't grow up around boys. And watching Lauren, my daughter's comfort with Chase and his friends is pretty cool. And I think that, you know, there's kind of something neat about that, that you just growing up together, you kind of innately know the other gender a little bit better than I did. So that's cool. And, they, you know, Chase tolerates her, behavior a lot more. She's going to have to find a really great guy to marry because her brother's pretty good to her. But yeah, I think it's really like just a sociology experiment for me to kind of watch how they are growing and shaping and you know, and how they're not typical gender stereotypes either. You know, Chase is a very gentle, non-athletic, introspective, cerebral boy. And that's kind of an interesting thing, too, to watch. How do you fit in a world where, you know, our society kind of rewards more testosterone-driven behaviors.
Sure, sure.
So that's those are interesting conversations too in our house. So yeah, that could be a whole episode.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting because it is. We are so, I think, inclined to pursue, I guess, I don't know, normal, you know, this idea like, oh, this is what it is to be a boy. I saw some kind of, I have a friend of mine post on Facebook, a gender reveal like cake.
Yeah.
And it's like, and the cake was divided in two, and on the blue side, it was, there was a little gun and it said guns or, and then the other side, there was like a princess crown or glitter, guns or glitter. Like which of these is going to be my kid, you know? And like to consider that, like our children are far less than any sort of product of our society or culture, but really what we, who we are,
yes.
You know, and you mentioned like the unhealed parts of ourselves,
yes.
And that now certainly like we can default to culture. And we, I mean, again, like if you have a cake that says guns or glitter, like that, I think that that represents sort of an acquiescence to culture,
yes.
Just of saying like, oh, yep. If it's a boy, culture says they have to love guns and muscles. And so that's who my kid's going to be. And they have, if it's a girl, they have to love glitter. But if instead we offer them the freedom to sort of be who they are and allow them to be more well-rounded people, I think that's a very different path. So,
yeah. What do you love most about watching Lindsay raise two girls? Like what do you love watching as she mothers two young women?
Yeah. I love the earnestness with which she pays attention to her own wounds. So, I don't know, I think that my wife would be okay with me sharing some of this, but she was a gymnast and, it, you know, still deals with the trauma of the abuse that she endured from her gymnastics coaches, the psychological and, you know, emotional abuse, the you're not good enough unless you're perfect, the, you know, your body has to be a certain way, the, your health is secondary to your capacity to compete. You know, and those, and then also the broader wounds that she received as a part of just being a woman in the United States, being a woman in the world, but in particular, you know, the West, where there's a particular kind of body ideal and there's particular relationships to food and those types of things. And to see the ways in which she recognizes how her own struggle with those things will absolutely, left unchecked, shape the way that my daughters experience that. You know, I remember when I was in graduate school, there was a, we were in a class talking about, I think it was a class where we were talking about development, like human development, and the question of, we were having the conversation about race. And one woman who was a black woman said, I won't ever marry a white man because I couldn't trust him to effectively raise my black son or black daughter. Because there's so much that my black son or black daughter has to know about the world to be able to survive. You know, and so, and I'm not saying that that perspective is right or wrong, good or bad, but I think that what it signals is the sense of, if you just let the sort of default processes unfold, there's a lot of pain and a lot of wounds that are not necessarily the good kind of pain or wounds, right? That can develop into more pathology and you know, just the struggles of life. So I love watching her recognize that it's important with her to struggle with, to really do the work related to body image issues, to, you know, her relationship to food, to how she conceives health and fitness and those types of things. And, you know, as we last night we watched a terrific documentary, really, really hard to watch, but Athlete A, I don't know if that's one that you've, it essentially walks through the development of the case around USA Gymnastics and Larry Nassar.
Okay.
I mean, Lindsay was a gymnast, and so, we were both, you know, kind of tearing up for most of this documentary. But just to watch, like, these people have a relationship to a sport that they love. So like Lindsay and I, for example, are trying to ask the question, like, what do we want our daughters to participate in competitive sports in a sports culture that mm-hmm. has the capacity to bring out the best of them, but also might introduce them to a culture of abuse that we don't necessarily mm-hmm. want them to endure. And to see these athletes wrestling with that, wrestling with like, yeah, I love gymnastics, but I fully recognize and appreciate that I have endured abuse for my entire life because of the way gymnastics is set up. So it's a very complicated answer. But what I love is that she's not just, picking up a parenting book and saying, okay, well, here's how you discipline and here's how many carrots you give them. And here's, how often you should take them to the park. It's the, how have I absorbed, abuse and trauma and, really unproductive, gender norms or, beauty standards or whatever it is. And how can I raise daughters that look at that differently? I really appreciate watching that because again, it's one of those things that I, as a man who have not experienced the same kinds of things, similar things in some ways, but not nearly to the degree or to the type that Lindsay's experienced, I wouldn't be able to carry my daughters forward in the same way. So watching her do that is pretty cool. Let's see. What are you reading / watching / listening to right now that is changing you?
Oh my gosh. So it's an interesting week to ask that question because I have felt very overwhelmed with the readings I was doing, trying to better understand my privilege and mm-hmm. racism and I felt sad over the weekend of, I guess because it was 4th of July and, we're celebrating a nation. And my 15-year-old son, who thinks very deeply, was mm-hmm. like, why, what is the 4th of July all about in the lens of racism? Mm-hmm, so that was an interesting discussion because he was like, this isn't a celebration. We've got a lot of work to do kind of thing. So I think over the 4th of July, I was just feeling overwhelmed with like his children grow, what world will his children grow up in mm-hmm. and their children and feeling like we're not moving the needle far enough, fast enough, and the election coming up and oh yeah, yeah. So I thought, okay, I'm unplugging from all of this studying I'm doing. And my friend gifted me a masterclass mm-hmm. subscription. And it has been the coolest thing. So I am watching Natalie Portman teach acting.
Oh.
I'm watching Diane von Furstenberg, who's a dress designer, teach fashion design. And then the other one that I have really loved is Sarah Blakely, who invented Spanx.
Oh,
and
wow.
I've spent my drive time and like dishwasher loading and folding laundry listening to those three. And it has been just kind of a break I needed from heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They're fascinating women. And, so Natalie Portman teaches, I love her movies and acting. And so she's teaching how she gets into character.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. And how she picks up on nuances of characters mm-hmm. and does all this studying and research to just get mannerisms. And so that's been fun to hear about. And then Sarah Blakely, she invented Spanx. So if you don't know, if our listeners don't know what Spanx are, it was one of the first kind of body shaping mm-hmm. Line of hosiery. And so she was going to wear, her story is she was wearing white pants to a summer party and you could see through them. So she took a pair of heavy hosiery that she had in her closet and cut the feet out so that she could wear sandals with her white pants but mm-hmm. have her legs covered underneath. And that was the invention of Spanx. And she had $5,000 in savings and she decided she was going to invent these for women. And so she's very much a kind of entrepreneur mindset, very marketing driven, very mm-hmm. businessy. But what I have enjoyed is how she's trying to help entrepreneurs understand how to solve problems for people. So mm-hmm. what problem is somebody having? And then how can you solve it in an out-of-the-box, totally different way?
Yeah.
And so that kind of a piece of her entrepreneurial class has been really fascinating. So yeah, that's what I'm into this week.
Yeah, that's great. I I don't know anything about any of those, but Masterclass is the, I'd heard of the concept.
Yeah, and they have an app. And so my friend had bought a subscription for her business, and it came with two, buy one, get one. Mm-hmm. And so she gifted it to me, and it has been so much fun. There are a lot of writers writing about their process. It's a very kind of artistic mm-hmm. masterclass. And I think they have free trials, but there's a commercial for them.
We're trying.
There's a plug.
Sure.
They are fun. They're well produced and very worth your time.
Okay.
What was your first date with Lindsay?
The first date I remember. This is interesting. So we started dating when we were sophomores in high school, and I am my birthday was kind of like a late in the year kind of thing. So sophomore year, you know, right at the beginning, there's like a handful of people. It's kind of, you know, it's a bell curve, you know, mm-hmm. over the course of the year, more and more people get their sort of driver's licenses mm-hmm. and can drive or whatever. I couldn't, I had to wait till late in the year, but I had this girl that I wanted to go on a date with. So, my buddy Kyle had his license. And he had a big old conversion van, like, you know, like not like a minivan, like mm-hmm. a big old van mm-hmm. was his ride. And so I wanted to take Lindsay to see a movie. And so I did. But Kyle had to drive us, my friend Kyle, you know, who's my grade. So here's the other challenge. The day of our date, Lindsay went to get her hair colored, but it like went awry. And so, like, it ended up being, like, green, and so she had to, like, get it dyed, like, really dark. Like, so her hair was growing up very, very blonde. And so she got it colored, but something went wrong. It ended up being green, so she had to get dyed, like, dark brown. And that kind of change was really jarring for Lindsay. So it felt like most of my work that evening was, like, soothing her, you know, like, you look great, it's, you know, it's wonderful or whatever, but, like, recognizing that that wasn't getting through, like, the wall of her insecurity, you know?
This is foreshadowing to your therapy career.
Yeah. that was our first date. My friend Kyle and I drove over in the conversion van. We hopped in the van together. I think we saw Friday Night Lights, the film, mm-hmm. which was based on the book. That was our first date. I think I might have called her parents to ask if it was okay if my friend Kyle and I drove her. 'Cause that was at the time where it's like, you don't just like hop in the car and drive. Right. Like you got to like ask permission. It's like, hey, it's like my buddy Kyle, he got his license 3 weeks ago. Right. We okay to, you know, jump in the conversion van and go to the movie theater.
Yeah.
So that was the,
that was considerate of you.
Well, I think I had a very old fashioned sense of things. Mm. You know, I asked Lindsay's permission the first like 300 times that I kissed her.
Oh.
Like each time individually,
so
like, and again, I don't know that it was like, I don't know how cool that was, but at a minimum, it was something that felt to me like, I don't know if it was like chivalry or if it was the budding feminist in me that wanted to get consent or whatever it was.
I think
but
it's a deep caring.
I think, and so in the same with the sort of relationship to her parents, because I think that I have two older sisters. And so I don't know if I sort of observed the way that people would engage them mm-hmm. and sort of seeing how my parents would respond. I think mm-hmm. my parents had more respect for young men who connected with my sisters and like that sort of considerate, affirming, you know, engaging the parents in the process kind of way, rather than people who just showed up and were like, yeah, whatever, I'm taking your daughter out, you know? So I think I wanted to be not that, but, that was our first date.
That's awesome. Oh, sweet. So you were 16?
I think I was 15 at the time. Mm-hmm. She was 15. Yeah, we were both 15.
Wow.
We dated for 2 months. And she broke up with me.
Okay.
And then about 6 months later, we dated again for about 4 or 5 months. Then she broke up with me again. And then a few months. And then after that second breakup, we were still kind of like attached to the hip. Like it was our junior year. I would give her a ride to and from school most days. Like we just spent kind of all of our time together. And then eventually we were just like, let's kind of do this. So, since our junior year, we've been kind of unbowed, unbent, unbroken, wow. just sort of been together since then.
How did you propose to her?
In the most sort of traditional way possible, we had gone to maybe 6 high school dances together, and our favorite place was EBT on State Line, Emery Bird there, which is no longer there. I mean, there's still like that restaurant is just like vacant, like that space is just vacant.
Such a cool space.
So we went there. I asked a couple weeks before. I asked her father permission. I took him out to Panera, and said, "Hey, I'd like to, you know, propose to Lindsay," and really asked just wanted to give him a heads up more than ask for permission. And then I wrote her a poem. Actually, what I think I did is I got her a book. I made like a photo book for her. And inside the photo book was a poem that I wrote, sort of just describing the history of our relationship together. And then the last 2 lines of the poem I had ripped off and kept in my own pocket. And they were, you know, like the only thing left for me to do is to get on one knee and say, "Lindsay, will you marry me?" And so I, you know, pulled that and then got on one knee and read that to her.
Oh my gosh.
And then there was a gal at another table who was like, "Did you just propose?" And like, there was this whole big scene, and everything was
that's fun, big though. Celebration. That a celebration.
And then the waitress came over about 10 minutes later and said, "Champagne." And we were 18.
Yeah.
So Lindsay was 19. I was 18. But we couldn't drink champagne, right. So they gave us a free dessert. But that's kind of how
that... And give the champagne to the woman at the next table.
Yeah, I don't know where the champagne ended up. I'm sure someone enjoyed it.
That's so cool. And how great that, like, your parents had, you know, both sets had, both families knew each other well at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's pretty cool because they knew who their daughter was marrying and knew you very well.
Yeah, and we've kind of remained close since then, but I think it really all just built upon, like, we cultivated a relationship, you know, that wasn't based in anything except connection. You know, we, again, so much, like, I think of this now and I think, like, I think of all the things that we did and the ways that we did it. And if anybody asked, like, how do you do a relationship? I wouldn't say, like, well, date for 4 years before you get married. Wait till you're married to have sex, ask the father's, like, I wouldn't say any of those things, you know, because again, it's very patriarchal. It's very, you know, very traditional or whatever. Like, I mean, certainly, like, I want to like allow for people's freedom to pursue those paths. But that just happens to be the path that we went on. And I think that we've been able to remain, you know, really closely connected because most of that foundation was built upon, you know, all the boundaries that come with developing a relationship that isn't based on, you know, living together or sex or, you know, any of those other types of things.
Yeah.
But, that was how we unfolded. Here's my next question for you. Question number 4, what do you love most about what you do?
Oh, wow. I think, there's so many things I love. 'Cause I've had like 13 careers. And so I think I finally found the thing. And so the thing I love the most is individual conversations with people where they trust me, they open, they get vulnerable to receiving maybe new insight. I think that's when I really love it is when somebody has kind of this realization of why they were stuck and why things weren't working and why life was a struggle. And then they come up with the way they can get themselves out of it. And getting to witness that is just the coolest thing. And you know, the more, so it's been about 4 or 5 years now of meeting with people individually and, you know, I can start to see it coming. Like you start to see the breakthrough coming. Like they, you know, you know, they're getting close to finding this key piece of their story that had gone either unnoticed or suppressed or unexplained in their brain. And then that kind of all comes together and people just, it's like liberation. It's watching somebody liberate themselves.
Yeah.
And that I think is just so fascinating to me and so rewarding that I get a front row seat to see that and maybe get to foster a space where they can find themselves. I think that, you know, when I really boil down my work, I think it's really helping people overcome self-doubt.
Mm.
And, you know, and self-doubt comes from so many different angles into our lives, but we start to believe the messages that we've either heard or imagined or been told. And to help somebody believe in themselves again is what I love the most. And I think that it kind of struck me when I was in seminary trying to figure out where am I going to take this theological education and what am I uniquely called to do with this education? And I realized that it was really the fundamental sense of worthiness was mm-hmm. super important to me, that a human would know they were inherently worthy.
Yeah.
And that's then what really, that kind of epiphany to me in my own theological and spiritual journey, because I struggled with that myself. And so I think that's when it all kind of aligned of like, this is the work I'm meant to do. And then mm-hmm. every day I just get to validate and affirm that and that sense of calling. So, you know, I've had a lot of, I don't know, 3 or 4 people say this randomly of, I'm so glad you found what you were meant to do. And I feel like that's a message, I don't know, from, you know, cosmic universally. When I get in my own self-doubt, those messages kind of come to me. And I am so grateful that people say that, because then I'm reminded of like, oh, yeah, this, you know, it's not about fixing anything. It's about compassion. And that's the irony of my business name is Compassion Fix. It's just really, I think compassion fixes everything. And there's not a quick fix out there. It's more this, we sit together soul to soul, heart to heart, and we just try to both figure it out to the best of our ability. And that's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. That to me, I think is, I think for both of us, like the work that we do is, I remember, and I've referenced this before, the movie, now I'm blanking, A Dangerous Method, about Freud and Jung. And one of the things that Freud says to Jung is like, you have to give up trying to cure them.
Yes.
And I just remember like being like, well, but isn't that like the whole point of what you're doing? And, but so much of a thing, what you're describing is like, we're like, you know, seasoned passengers, mm-hmm. On a journey that folks like just haven't taken before.
Right.
You know, I don't want to be guilty of cultural appropriation here, but like we're Sherpas, you know, but we've, you know, we're acclimated to the mountain. We've been up the mountain before. But fundamentally, like we can't carry you up the mountain. You know, you've got to do that work yourself. Part of what we do is we say, yeah, you can do it. Let me show you that you can do it. Let me help you see terrain, differently than you've seen it before. Let me, show you how to use these tools that are going to help you get up. But fundamentally, you're the one doing the work. And unlocking somebody's sort of inner sense of value I would agree that that's like to me the most transformative thing that we can do is just offer that affirming presence to people.
So cool. What do you love most about being a therapist?
Well, I just said it.
Okay.
No, I do love that.
You work with couples.
Yes,
too.
I mostly work with couples, and I think for me, and I may have. I think I tried to say this to a couple yesterday, and I'm trying to remember the analogy that I used. It is, I think 9 times out of 10, when I'm sitting down with a couple, it is two people who love each other deeply, but have put on, so many layers of defensiveness, that they have become stubborn, and it's almost just like they just can't see each other anymore. You know, like they're like the medieval knights that have so much armor on that they can only see through this tiny little slit, and what they're seeing is not a reflection of reality. And so much of what I try to do with couples is just try to say like, let me help you get all this armor off, so that you can be truly vulnerable in front of your partner, and you can do so. You can be vulnerable and safe at the same time. I think so many people equate vulnerability with danger, and that's a fair place to end up. Like, I think your experience often tells you like, oh, well, if I'm vulnerable in front of somebody, they're going to hurt me. Mm-hmm. I think part of what I want to try to create for couples is this measure of safety where they can say, oh, like, we can find ways to connect with each other that allow us to be our most authentic selves. And then once you start to see that love flowing back and forth freely, they just basically rediscover themselves. And watching that happen is really a beautiful thing. I say 9 times out of 10, because there are some couples for whom there are deeply entrenched, deeply unhealthy, toxic dynamics of interaction that are far less about just, you know, taking the armor off, and it's more about like putting swords down, right? Yeah. So there's some of that dimension that looks a little bit different. But in any case of the couples that I work with, so much of what I want for them is just to be able to say like if you pay close enough attention, you realize that you really do love each other. You're just doing such a poor job of communicating it and connecting with each other that it feels so disconnected.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, what I enjoy most is when you start to see that happen. And I always remind couples, and this is kind of what you were saying, is, you know, if I meet with you for an hour a week, I see you at 1 out of every 168 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that there's 167 hours of the week where you're the one doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, all I can do is just to say, you know, here's something that you can consider, but the actual work of developing that connection is something you do on your own.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful to me to be able to sit with a couple after meeting them for, you know, 3 months, 6 months, or however long, and see them as deeply in love as they've ever been, mm-hmm. and say like, you're the ones that did it.
That's,
you know,
awesome.
I may have given you some pointers along the way, but the work of actually opening your hearts to each other is work that I couldn't do if I tried.
Right.
You have to be able to do that with each other. And so watching that and being able to, cause they'll look at me and they say, oh, like, thank you for, you know, mm-hmm. for rescuing us,
right.
or saving us. And I'm like, you guys
did it.
Yeah. Most of what I was doing was, you know, walking alongside you. So that's, I think, what I enjoy most, about working with couples.
Yeah.
So my last question for you,
okay.
is, what is your go-to candy?
Oh, wow. Reese's.
Reese's
peanut butter cups.
That's
yeah.
So tell me about
not Reese's pieces. I like those are second.
so you like the peanut butter or chocolate combination?
Yes. Anything in that combination. Ice cream in that combination. Pie in that combination.
Okay.
Yes. And it's fun that my daughter loves baking now, and so she has been concocting all of these peanut butter chocolate things.
That's great.
That are pretty fun.
So my wife has this, like, you know, these snacks that mm-hmm. she's put together, and one of them are apple nachos.
Oh.
So essentially you just slice apples into some thin slices. And then the way that she likes to eat them the most is we take Nutella.
Ah,
and then we take crunchy peanut butter.
Yes.
And sort of melt and mix them together and then put those over the apple nachos.
This later today.
and it's incredible. I mean, it's, yeah, I remember saying, I discovered like the peanut butter cups, and they're more expensive, and you can't find them everywhere. The first place I found them was at Sam's Club, but it's like real peanut butter inside of a peanut butter cup.
What brand?
Like Sam's Club brand or something
okay,
like that.
Okay,
yeah. And I remember eating them, and I remember telling a group of people like, oh my gosh, you got to try these. These are better
it's
than Reese's.
Yeah.
And then one guy was like, I tried them. They're not better than Reese's. Like,
that's my guy.
the interesting thing is like, what is inside of Reese's is not peanut butter. It's got a peanut butter-ish
right.
flavor, but
is it a texture thing for you? Like, was it a creamier texture?
Maybe just, you know, the decadence of it. I don't know.
Right.
But there was something about it that I really enjoyed. But yeah, I agree that that's a good combination.
Mm-hmm. What's yours?
I just want to point out to our listeners that most of what Ginger has done in her questions is said, okay, well, same question, but to you, which is fine.
Thank you. I'm sure they caught on to that already. I was aware I was doing that also. But I do want to know, and then I will give you one more question.
Okay.
How about that?
So I like most candy. I don't know that I've come across a candy that I truly don't like. I think that what I gravitate toward most often are some kind of just like good but mostly plain chocolate.
Okay.
It's easy for me to kind of get overwhelmed with flavor
yes.
combinations. So even just like, you know, like a Hershey's chocolate bar or something super simple. Yeah. On the chocolate spectrum though, my favorite thing is like a Crunch bar.
Mm, okay.
And then on the sort of fruity spectrum, I like Skittles quite a lot. When I was in high school, I had a bag of Lemonheads in my car at all times. I ate more I was keeping Lemonheads in business as a candy brand. I don't know why I loved them so much, like to the point where like my mouth would start to hurt because of all the acidity. But those are kind of my go-tos. But honestly, like I said, I'm very indiscriminate when it comes to candy.
What's Lindsay's favorite?
I think she would probably say Reese's. We did this thing. We just went camping over the 4th of July weekend and we made s'mores and we put Reese's on the s'more.
I
want
to do that.
It was terrific. Okay. I mean, the challenge is you've got to let it rest for a little. It's kind of like a steak, like, you know, like when you take a steak off the grill, let it rest for 5 minutes. So same thing. So just so that the marshmallow can effectively melt the most of the Reese's. It was great. Like, I don't know that I'll ever be able to I could have a regular Reese's or a regular s'more, but I would need to also have a Reese's s'more with it. So, Okay. Final question.
Okay. When are you and Lindsay at your very best together?
When our kids are not at home. I know that feels unfair.
No, I get that deeply. Yes.
I think that, and honestly, like, there's an argument to be made that, like, that's really hit or miss, because I think sometimes we put such high expectations on ourselves when our kids are out of the house that, like, we end up self-sabotaging, right?
Exactly.
You know, we are at our best when we are balanced as individuals. And that's easiest to do when the kids are cared for by one of our parents, you know, by granny or Nana. But it's when I have an effective balance between, you know, work and rest and family and those types of things. And when she has that similar kind of balance, and it is really hard to achieve that most of the time. I think we try to create some intentionality about it, but when we are able to see those moments where we're just like really deeply connected, it always flows from a sense of like the scales aren't too tipped in one direction or another. You know, we're working as much as we need to work to fulfill our sense of like, you know, call. We're connecting with family as much as we need to feel like we are living into our values. We're resting as much as we need to, you know, we're getting the sleep that we need to get. And again, what flows from that is a capacity to have like intimate conversations and to have sex more often and to do the types of things that we love doing that draw us into closer connection with each other. Because we can't do those when we're working too much, when we're not getting enough sleep, when we're, sort of making family connection sort of secondary or tertiary. So that may feel like I don't know if that's a fair answer or not, but that to me is, the whole family systems concept of like individuation or differentiation is this idea that like you can be your best self and the other people in your life can be their best selves. And that is what allows for the capacity of like full relationship. I think a lot of people would say like, oh, like let's just make the relationship primary. I think that the relationship is part of like tier one, but you know, before you can show up as your best self in a relationship, you have to be paying attention to your own needs and your own sense of balance as well. So that'd be my answer to that. I think we effectively plumbed the depths of one another's souls and relationships, and hopefully there's some wisdom and truth in there. We'll let the listeners take that for what it is. We will wish you all a continued safe season as we navigate the coronavirus and all that. Ginger, anything else you want to say as we wrap up today?
No, this was fun. I liked it.
Yeah. A welcome respite from some of the heavier topics we've been visiting lately.
That's right.
Well, if you want to learn more about my practice, you can go to talkingwithjames.com.
And you can find me at compassionfix.com.
We will be back next Friday with something cool, I imagine. Yes. And until then,
be well.